folks, and old friend or old acquaintance, because we never knew each other that well, Lee Robshaw. Welcome to Bay FM.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great pleasure to have you. You live up on the Sunshine Coast.
Mm-hmm. And I do. I live in Mullaney.
In Mullaney.
Yeah. Hinterland.
One of the best places in the world also.
Top spot. Yeah.
Do you go to the festival every year to Woodford?
I used to go every single year. Would not have missed it for the world. Mm. Last year I didn't go because I just thought I can't handle the heat. Like it is so hot there, but they had perfect weather. It wasn't even hot. So
you never know, do you? Because I've been there a couple of times when the weather's been perfect, and a couple of times when it has really not been perfect. Once it was so much rain, we got our van completely stuck. I had to get a tractor to pull us out at the end of the festival, which is okay.
Yeah, well, it was always either a mud fest or really hot.
Or a dust fest.
But now they've got a big sort of permaculture swimming hole that people can swim in. But they charge money to go in there, so I don't know how successful that's going to be.
Now, you have written your first feature-length book. Maybe it will be a movie.
Yeah, might be a feature film one day.
Yes, it's called You Had Me at Hola, and yes. I said hola before incorrectly. Of course, the Spanish is, the H is silent. Apologies to those Spanish and Portuguese, I think, also. You Had Me at Hola, In Search of Love and Truth in South America, and a tale that goes back to the 90s, I'd say 20-odd years ago.
Yeah, yes.
It's taking you that long to write it. When did you start writing the book?
It took me that long to think about how I wanted to write it. Mm. I went through a long process of deciding whether to make it fiction or memoir, and I was too scared to write a memoir. But every time I tried to write it as fiction, it just didn't really feel authentic because I lived the story and it was a true story. Mm. So once I got over myself and decided I'm not going to worry what anyone thinks of me, I wrote it as a memoir. So it did. Once I sat down and started actually writing it, it took about 7 years on and off.
Yeah.
So
wow.
Combined with work and kids.
And was it time and distance that enabled you to write it as a memoir straight up rather than try and fictionalise it to some degree?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And I had to really dig deep and think about what was driving me to do the trip, because you can write a book about doing a trip, but if it's just we got on this bus and we got on that bus, it's going to be pretty boring. So I had to really think about the backstory and why I would, at the age of 23, go and throw myself into some pretty crazy, wild situations in South America. And so there's a lot of childhood trauma and things in it as well, that is kind of the underlying story. And
that's kind of the reason you went on this trip initially, is to kind of find yourself in this way, to make sense of a life which did encompass quite a lot of trauma, addiction, and other experiences. Do you want to speak a little bit about that, frame that a little bit?
Yeah, so I grew up in Western Sydney, and my biological dad was a heroin addict, and my mum had to sort of raise my brother and I on her own, and it was pretty tough. And he wasn't really involved in our lives. He was in and out of our lives a bit, but it was always a very confusing situation for me because I didn't actually know. No one tells kids, like, this is what's going on. It's just your dad's not around, and sometimes he is and sometimes he's not, and why does he look like that? And so it's a very confusing situation. And then my mum was not coping, and at one point we got taken off her and put into a home. So my brother and I spent some time in kind of a Catholic children's home, which was quite sort of weird at the age of about five.
I'm sure
to be separated from our mum. And so, yeah, I grew up with a lot of, insecurity and not much of a sense of belonging and that sort of thing. So I was going in search of that.
So you do cover some of that as it comes up in the journey, because what happens is 72 hours after you arrive in Peru, you meet from London, I think.
From Australia.
From Australia, because you're heading to London and you got waylaid. Basically, you're going to pass through for a short time in South
Definitely
America.
Definitely got waylaid.
And 72 hours after you meet Gabriel, who is was a Peruvian artisan, and everything changed. And as you say in your publicity, you say, I believe that there was a past life connection. It was an instant connection. Mm. And you do believe in that, in karma and soulmates and that sort of thing to a degree, or you did at that time. Do you believe in that before you met this guy, or did you suddenly go, oh, this is something else?
Both. At that time, I was a massive rampant new ager, so I was like, like everything from firewalking to past lives to inner child stuff to, you know.
Does it sound familiar out there, folks?
Tarot readings, you name it. And so, yes, I did feel that it was a past life connection. I felt completely comfortable and at home the second I arrived. And I actually met him in Buenos Aires. He was Peruvian. Okay. He is Peruvian. Mm. But he was working at a market in Buenos Aires, and later we lived with his family in Peru. But I did feel it was a, whether it's past life or not, who knows, but it was definitely a deep, intense...
Mm. Recognition of each other.
Yeah, on a really kind of soul level. Like, I couldn't speak Spanish when I first met him, and he didn't speak any English. But I felt like I knew him already. And then as I did learn Spanish and become fluent, he was the person that I felt he was when I first met him. So,
and you spent the whole relationship speaking in Spanish, in fact.
Yeah, because, he had no need to learn English, really. He was in his land. So I was happy to. It's a good way to learn a language, you know, falling in love with someone that doesn't speak English.
Yes, highly recommended for you, even though things change. We'll get to that very shortly. But he also, as you alluded to just a second ago, you felt very much at home in South America anyway, didn't you? There was some sort of sense of like, oh.
I did. Yeah,
so what did that feel like? What was that about?
Oh, just not a lot of fear or feeling out of place. Like, after that trip, I went and lived in Japan for a year, and I felt completely out of place the entire time I was there. I just felt like this place is wrong for me. I never felt comfortable. I just did not feel right in myself there. But South America, no matter where I went, I felt welcomed, and I just felt at peace and calm and happy, and just like, this is the place for me. This is where I'm meant to be.
So some good friends of mine on the property that I live have just come back from Peru and other places in South America, and they had the same sort of experience in a way, feeling really comfortable and such a real beautiful family, friendly, open, relatively uncomplicated vibe, despite the fact that, of course, these days many of those South American countries are in political chaos for one reason or another. We won't go into the politics of that right now, but that sort of sense that there's something more connected and natural generally there.
Yeah, and a lot of people are really drawn, especially to places like Peru, and it feels like some sort of spiritual center. I don't know why, but there is some strong energy there where you do feel really connected to the earth, and they. Mm. Yeah, as a culture, they're very warm people as well. So they're very welcoming, and you know, most people are poor, but they'll give you the shirt off their back, really, and welcome you into their house, and you know, give you food and take care of you, unless they're thieves, in which case they'll rob you.
Pretty much the same everywhere, I think, that one. Now, we do have, before we move on, you've brought in two books, very lovely-looking publication, folks, two books to give away to Bay FM subscribers. So if you wish to call us up now, if you're a subscriber, 66807999, Susie is out there and she'll take your call. Susie or one of the other wonderful people out there in the office space. You have me at Ola, In Search of Love and Truth in South America. By Lee Robshaw. Two copies of that, so give us a call. The phone's going off already, so that's great. 66807999 if you are a subscriber to Bay FM. If you're not a subscriber, you could go, hey, I'll call up and I'll put my money down for a subscription, and then I'll be able to go in the draw for the book as well, and you could easily win it and get half your money back straight away. So there's an option as well. And you'll also go in the draw for the wonderful prize for this month's subscriber drive, which we do every month, which is a Balloon Aloft journey with the people from Balloon Aloft I had on the show a few weeks ago, in fact. Now, as the story unfolds, you meet Gabriel, but as the story unfolds, you discover that he's got a cocaine problem. So let's look at that first, because, of course, this brings up the resonance with your father and his heroin addiction. So how did that, because you actually see that smile on your face,
it's,
you go, oh, my goodness.
Alert.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
It's fine. It's not exactly, they don't have to read too far into the book to find that out. He kind of hid that from me, but he also didn't think it was a problem.
Drug problems don't think they have a problem. How odd is that?
Unusual. Neither did any of his friends or cousins, or it was just the done thing. And actually, cocaine in Lima was like $2 a gram of really pure stuff, so it was cheaper than alcohol. And so everyone did it. The bus drivers did it. Like, every bus you would get on, they looked like they were coked out of the eyeballs. So, he didn't really see it as a problem, but... Well, he said he didn't, but then later on he did admit that it was a problem when he was going through a psychosis, a cocaine psychosis, and he had been hospitalised and things like that, which I didn't find out till much later. And I said, if I'm going to stay and we're going to travel, we wanted to travel up to Mexico and find somewhere to live there by the beach, and you have to stay off it. And he mostly did until he didn't.
And you're kind of, as I understand, sort of a bit on the run there for a while with all of that. When you came back, because you left after you found out that he had a problem, some time elapsed, and you decided to go to London. And a whole other thing happens here with a chap called Stuart Wilde. Now, for many older listeners particularly out there, may be familiar with Stuart Wilde. He was a bit of an icon of the New Age movement in the 80s, 90s, and I came across him in the 80s in Sydney with his collection of people who were sort of under the auspices of a chap called Old Chinese, right? Because I can't remember that much about it. I was associated with a couple of these people, and I think I met Stuart once or twice in Sydney when he was there, but I don't remember him so well, although he was such a character. So just the old Chinese thing, because that was a whole thing at the time, wasn't it?
It was a big thing. He was... there was a man, I'm pretty sure his name was Marshall Lever, who channeled old Chinese, this old Chinese spirit, who handed down these teachings to a group of people. And Stuart was one, and Denise Lin, I'm pretty sure, was another one. She was an American author.
Denise Lin,
do you remember
Denise
her?
Lin, I remember Denise Lin, yes,
yeah,
I do.
She was in the group, and Glenn Brady,
and
a few teachers that went on to do some pretty interesting stuff. So, yeah, they were this little cartel of...
A cartel. Choose that word carefully.
Cartel of enlightened...
South America. Cartel.
Of enlightened beings going out to... spread their teachings around the world. So I don't know if they're enlightened beings, but they certainly had some interesting stuff to pass on from old Chinese.
Yeah, well, Stuart, you ended up developing a close relationship with him in terms of, I guess, mentor and whatever that was.
Yeah.
You have to read the book to find out, folks. But he helped you move through quite a lot of your own psychological baggage, if you will, at that time.
He did, yeah. He really took me under his wing, and I had met him in Sydney through Leon Naxon, who is the CEO of Hay House now. I worked for him, and he had a newspaper called The Planet that was my first job while I was still at uni, and he introduced me to Stuart, and so I didn't know Stuart very well, but he said, when you turn up in London, just give him a call and see if he's got any work going, which I did, and Stu said, no, but I'll meet you for a beer. And one beer turned into five as we talked about all the hallucinogenic drugs in South America that Stuart was really fascinated by. He hadn't gotten into all that at that point. And, we really hit it off, and he invited me to start working for him one day a week in his apartment in Notting Hill, which was really fancy for a poor backpacker. And one day turned into five, and I was working full-time, and then I was living in his apartment when he went to do his... courses, his Warriors in the Mist and things like that in America. And I ended up, his personal assistant friend, he had a girlfriend who was a model, and she was often away, and he'd be quite lonely at times, and he'd want me to stay and eat dinner and things like that. And he was amazing to me. He saw that I had a really, really deeply ingrained poverty mentality, and he was all about, you know, abundance and wealth creation and all that sort of thing, and empowering yourself and not being part of TikTok and not
being part of TikTok.
Yeah, he called it TikTok and not, you know, being in debt to a bank to buy a house for the rest of your life and all that sort of thing. So he used to send me over the road to buy chocolate, and I'd come back with cheap chocolate, and he'd send me back and say, get the expensive stuff. And he just kept sort of, and he took me out to really expensive restaurants in London, really posh restaurants, and I, you know, looked like a bedraggled hippie traveller, and he did not care. He was a, you know, stylish 50-year-old man, and he just made it his sort of job to, I guess, make me realise I was worthwhile as a person, and that it was okay for me to want money, because I thought there was something bad about money.
Also, now you've written a book. That's a smart move.
Yeah, it's really smart, isn't it?
I'm talking here to Lee Robshaw, the author of the new book, You Had Me at Hola, In Search of Love and Truth in South America. Two copies that we have here to give away to you as a subscriber to Bay FM, 6680799. Run it for a few more minutes while I'm talking to Lee for another 10 minutes or so, and we'll do the draw a bit later on in the show. With all of that in London with Stuart, all this quite amazing tale in itself, you go back to Peru to join Gabriel again and to live with his family. What happens then?
Oh,
without
wow.
giving too much away, I know we don't have too many spoilers here.
So there were three or four generations living under one roof in his house in Callao, which is quite a dangerous part of Lima. It's where the port is and the airport, and I was sort of under house arrest. I wasn't really allowed to leave the house on my own because it was just a, you know,
really, that?
I would have been I was a target, really, okay. having blonde hair. And so they were lovely and welcomed me into their home. It was very awkward and difficult because I was a strict vegetarian and they just did not understand that at all and thought I was just being rude, not wanting to eat their food. And if I went back now, I would just eat it. But being 23, I was like, nope, this does not align with my ethics. And so that was really hard, living in their house and not really being, not eating their food, not really speaking the language much. And also his mother was very Catholic and didn't really approve of us sleeping in the same room or bed. And there were lots of things to kind of deal with. And also his brother had had a terrible accident and was basically brain damaged, and then his best friend, who we used to go out with a lot, had a terrible accident as well. So there was lots of crazy stuff going on there.
So you eventually take to the road, you leave Lima and you take to the road as traveling artisans.
Yeah.
And off you go. And how long was that the gypsy life? What did that last for?
A couple of years until we settled down in Playa del Carmen, which is it's sort of in between Cancun and Tulum, on the Caribbean coast of
Mexico. Back in the day when it was pretty empty, nothing much was happening there. Different now. It's an Instagram place,
famous,
isn't it?
Yeah, yes. Tulum is...
Influencers go there to photograph themselves and make money.
They totally do.
Ridiculous
and there was,
stuff.
There was nothing in Tulum 20 years ago, like really not much at all. And we used to just go and hang out on the beach there and there was really nothing else there, and now it's really the cool place to go. And Playa del Carmen was quite small too, and now that's massive and has Starbucks and all sorts of stuff, so that's a bit of a shame. It was Playa del Carmen back then was an amazing, idyllic little Mexican fishing village where we were able to make a really good living selling jewelry. And I pictured myself being there for the rest of my life.
Well, without giving away what happened, because you're not there now, you're obviously not with Gabrielle. No. Years have passed by, all sorts of things have happened. So in the end, I want to get to, you mentioned psychedelics before, we'll come back to that in a second to finish up with, because that's interesting. But what happened for you, maybe that's part of the end anyway, but what happened for you that without giving it away?
I grew increasingly dissatisfied, I guess, with the life there, and I was trying to be an artisan, but I was really bad at it. I could not do it. I'm not good at craft. I'm terrible with my hands. And I would just get the shits and chuck it across the room if I was trying to make a necklace, and I couldn't, I just had no patience, basically. And so I was trying to force myself into doing this job I had glamorized and romanticized, and I was terrible at it. And also our relationship started breaking down due to some incidences that happened there, and I had to make a choice between my soulmate and my soul.
Yes, you say that, and that's an interesting thing. And the notion of a soulmate, just what's your take now? I mean, because I think many of us, especially if we've been involved in the New Age world at some point or other in our lives, have this idea that there's a soulmate or a twin soul. Those are different concepts, I think, anyway. But the soulmate thing, what's your position with that now? Is there such a thing?
I don't know now.
The wisdom of age. and experience.
I don't think there's just one soulmate. No. I don't. I think that we make choices and decide whether we want to, be with someone and do the hard work to make a relationship keep going, really. And it sort of sounds like magic if you say, oh, that person's my soulmate. It's just going to magically be okay and make it work without doing any hard work or something? Like you're just destined to be together?
Oh, God, yes, indeed. I think Bruce Lipton, who's here at the moment, wrote the book The Honeymoon Effect, which talks very much about the hormonal rush that occurs in the first year or so. If you're lucky, maybe you get 2 years out of it, and often maybe you get 6 months.
All the oxytocin.
All the oxytocin, dopamine, everything sort of floods through the system. It's like, oh, this is... and then you wake up from the dream, actually. Either you have to do the hard work or you get sort of ejected out one way or the other.
Yeah, and yeah, it's about priorities and putting the time in and deciding, yeah, this is the person I want to be with, and I'm going to put tons of work into getting to know them and myself, because, you know, usually you fall in love with someone and it's your idea of who they are, and then the real them comes out and the real you comes out, and it's all on.
I love it. Yeah, totally relate, and I'm sure almost everybody out there can. Now, to finish up, just because it is apparently the final chapter, so I don't want you to give it away, but it's interesting because I talk on this show a bit about psychedelics, the new psychedelic revolution, if you will, and certainly on my other show on Monday mornings on Future Sense with Steve McDonald, we talk about this issue of the medicinal use of plant medicines, which clearly is moving forward finally into the world 50 years after it was all banned, as most of us know, and it's a clearly scientifically driven experience and an area of discovery that's moving forward. And, of course, the underground, and especially in this area and also around your area too, the underground in this area is very big, as most people do know.
Yeah.
But you had quite a strong experience with peyote.
Yeah, I did.
Do you want to give us a little, without, again, giving too much away for the final chapter, what that was like and why you did it at that time?
It was something that I felt I needed to do to find purpose and direction, and I kind of thought it would be a bit fun as well. Was just an amazing experience. I walked into the desert not really knowing. It's quite magical, peyote, because you might not find it. Like, the desert's massive and you just kind of have to wander in. And
you literally went looking and
I went to a place called Real de Catorce, which is up in the north of Mexico, and basically spoke to locals, and I was with Gabriel, and they said, you know, what you have to do is see that massive desert over there, walk for hours until you basically spot some peyote, and it's like a little round flat kind of it's not like a tall cactus. It's like a little round flat thing, and they grow under these particular bushes. And we walked for hours and hours and hours and couldn't find any. And I was told once you find one, then they'll all magically appear, and they did. And I found the first one, and you have to do a ceremony. You have to kneel down on the earth and eat it straight out of the ground and
strong
with respect. And that's in terms of the indigenous Wichol people would do that, because it's a sacred plant for them, and it's not a party drug. And I did that, and then we started seeing them everywhere and collecting them, and we set up our tent and built a fire and spent the night in the desert having an amazing experience where I felt totally connected to the entire universe, all the plants, all the animals, all the rocks.
Of course, what you're saying, of course, is a fairly common experience for many people who've experimented with these substances. What's it left you with? What did it leave you with? It's still current for you now, that is influential in your life now.
It left me with the knowledge that we're all connected, and everything in the universe is connected by a massive system of web strings that tie us all together and connect us to nature, to the trees, to the stars. We are all connected, and we forget that. It's very easy in our daily lives to forget that we're kind of like all drops in the ocean, and we're all part of this one big thing. And we walk around thinking that what we do is, you know, we're independent and what we do doesn't particularly affect everything else around us, but it does. We're part of an intricate system of web strings, and we just need to be reminded of that sometimes, and it helps you to become a more compassionate empathic person, I think, when you look at other people through that lens rather than through a lens of judgment and criticism. When you look at someone and see them as connected to you, then hopefully you'll be kinder.
Beautiful. Indeed. And last question, are you still in contact with Gabrielle at all?
We were in contact up until the book came out.
Okay.
That's only because we were Facebook friends and we were messaging, and I told him all about the book and said what is going to be in it, and I said it's going to be warts and all, and do you want me to change your name? He said yes, so that's not his real name.
Yep.
And I said, I'll have to unfriend you on Facebook because you're the only friend of mine with a Latin American name, and readers might come and track you down and find out who you are. So I unfriended him and I gave him my contact details if he needs to contact me. He lives in Switzerland now, and he married a Swiss girl and had a daughter, and I had a son. We weren't in touch at that time, and I called my son Jasper and he called his daughter Jade, and they were two of the stones that we used to sell. So
how about that?
When we got back in touch, we went, oh, wow, interesting.
Beautiful. Well, Lee Robshaw, thanks for joining me. Very interesting. And as I said, there's two copies here, courtesy of Lee, of the book, You Had Me at Hola, In Search of Love and Truth in South America. Already we've got a number of calls in the bucket. I'll keep it running for a little bit longer into the next segment, so you can still have a chance to call up if you are a subscriber. 6680799, and the phone's going off again. Excellent. Thanks, Lee. Great pleasure.
Thank you, Nick.
Talk to you again.